After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm speaking today with Adriana Limbach. Adriana is a meditation instructor, personal development coach, and the author of the book, Tea and Cake with Demons. Her work has been featured by the New York Times, Refinery 29, Women's Health, and Yoga Journal. She's been hosting group coaching programs for coaches and training at the Institute for Integrative Nutrition since 2009, and is currently a lead teacher at Mindful, that's Mindful with no vowels, meditation studio, where she is a mentor and faculty for their 300-hour teacher training program. Welcome to the Metta Hour, Adriana.
Sharon, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to be here.
It's nice to see you. I haven't seen you in a while.
Yeah.
So huge congratulations on your book. This is your first book, right?
It is my first book.
Yep. That's an amazing milestone. That's really great. So to start with, why don't we talk about some of your journey, how you started meditating, and your path to teaching.
It's such a funny thing to talk about because I feel like anything, it seems like all of the dots kind of connect in retrospect. But of course, you know, it was not ever that linear. So I first started meditating back in high school. I was a junior in high school, and I grew up in Wisconsin. You'll hear the hard vowels. And it was a college town that I lived in. It was a pretty small town, but it was a college town. So, you know, during the semesters, it would kind of like ripen to three times its size. And the campus that I went to high school at didn't really have kind of enough room for all of us to physically be there. So the way that it was set up is kind of with electives. So we were able to take different courses to fulfill different requirements. And one of the history courses that was offered was a class called A History of Great Ideas. And I didn't know what it was when I was signing up for it. I just knew that I wanted to take a class with this particular teacher. His name is Mr. Siebert. And I would see him walking around the high school, really grumpy guy. He was always kind of like a little disheveled and very grumpy. And but he had such a kind of like funny sweetness to him, just like a wonderful weirdo. I was like, all right, I want to take a class with this guy. The only class that he teaches is A History of Great Ideas. And it turned out to be a class on Eastern philosophy. So we studied Taoism and Hinduism and Buddhism. And that was my first sort of real taste of meditation and also Buddhist view. And I remember so clearly kind of this real arrow to the heart moment in class. He was, you know, talking about one of the kind of hallmarks of Buddhist view is the idea of non-self, that we don't exist inherently the way that we think that we do. And I remember what a kind of terrifying feeling it was even to hear him say that, of like, oh, I, you know, I am the prom queen. I work very hard on the way that I exist in the world. Like, what do you mean I don't exist the way that I think that I do? And it was just enough for me to decide that I wanted to learn more. Like, it really haunted me. It was a very unsettling feeling that I couldn't shake. And so I wanted to explore more. So I started in high school meditating and kind of looking around for whatever resources were available. Of course.
How did you learn what to do?
Yeah, there was basic instruction that was given in our mm-hmm. in our class. And then I just started kind of like digging up resources. I fell in love with Alan Watts. He was kind of one of the big firsts, going to the library and taking out his cassettes, his like lectures on tape. And so that was my first kind of foray into meditation. And then after high school, I decided to do a little bit of traveling just as a way of prolonging that inevitable question of, you know, what do you want to do with your life? Which always felt a little kind of confining and solid and terrifying in its own right. So I decided to do some traveling, ended up in Thailand, and that mm-hmm. gave me kind of like another hit of exposure, just enough to sort of pique my interest and my curiosity. And then I ended up moving to New York City, you know, just maybe as another way of kind of infinitely prolonging the answer to the question, mm-hmm. what do you want to do with your life? I'm like, well, I'll move to New York and maybe I'll figure it out there. And, you know, of course, living in New York, 19, 20, stopped meditating, started partying, having a really good time. Found myself at 25 having kind of the like classic, what we would call now quarter life crisis of, you know, oh my gosh, what am I doing? I live in the most expensive city in the world. I'm not where I thought that I would be or should be, or, you know, I don't actually want to pursue this thing that I've been going to school for, which was costume design at Parsons. And I felt like a wreck. I felt like everybody else has their life figured out
mm-hmm.
except for me. I have no idea what I'm doing, and I am a total failure at 25 years old. And my roommate at the time was taking classes at the Interdependence Project down on the Bowery, and she said, you know, hey, you know that meditation thing that you used to do, that might actually be really helpful for you right now, which is, you know, how I found myself kind of walking up all of those flights of stairs.
Oh, I remember those stairs.
At 302 Bowery. And yeah, I'm so thankful that that was a consistent space to drop back into, because of course she was right in the middle of my kind of, you know, identity crisis and panic. Meditation actually was an incredibly helpful thing to mm-hmm. plug back into.
This is very interesting to me, both because, also because I started my acquaintance really with the Buddhist teaching in college in a class, mm-hmm. an Asian philosophy class, but there was no hint of a method, you know, of an actual how to mm-hmm. put these principles and these values into practice. And that's how I ended up going to India as an independent study student and actually learning a method. And so in a way, it sounds like you started without the ability to ask anybody any questions, right? You just had some ideas about what to do and you put it into practice on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Which I remember you talking a lot about in your book, Faith, and I mm-hmm. have to thank you for, because your book, Faith, was so pivotal to me, particularly, you know, in that like 24, 25 range when I was kind of just rediscovering mm-hmm. my practice. And it was such a personal account of your own experience, mm-hmm. which, you know, really made it feel so relatable. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the Interdependence Project was the first time, well, not Thailand, I guess, was the first time that you had a more explicit sense of guidance and the ability to ask questions, which seems very important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I did. After that course in high school, you know, came to its inevitable conclusion. I found myself just kind of like floating and scratching around for resources, but, you know, not actually, you know, as you're saying, being able to have a dialogue with other people, with teachers or community, or just kind of winging it.
Yeah. Well, of course, even now, this wasn't so many years ago for you, but enough so that it feels like the landscape is different in terms of availability and accessibility of these core principles, and certainly methods that are much more available now. So it's different.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Google. Yeah. We can find anything that we want or need in 30 seconds or less, which, you know, I personal opinion feel like it comes with its own set of challenges, because the information is so readily available and not necessarily kind of vetted in a way that we're sort of, the landscape is flooded. Mm-hmm. And so it maybe requires a bit of extra digging onto its own right, to kind of sift through all of the information that's out there.
It's true. Like people say to me sometimes, how do I find a teacher? Or how do I find a sitting group to be part of? And I say, well, if I'm going to a town that I've never been to before, I might just Google Insight Meditation and the name of the town. And then I realize, well, they don't know necessarily to put in Insight Meditation, you know? And I wonder what would come up if you just put in meditation and the name of the town. Would probably be a big variety. And how do you know? How do you know? How do you choose?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really great question. How do you choose? How do you choose? And particularly if you're just looking for meditation, because, you know, there are so many different types of meditation, both kind of traditional meditation that comes from some kind of lineage, and also, like, you know, meditation that maybe is just makes you feel good for a few minutes, but doesn't necessarily have kind of a root or a source that is traceable. Yeah.
So have you found yourself sort of in a translation project of taking what sounds like teachings that you received in a fairly traditional environment, certainly with an Asian root, you know, in sense of lineage, and translating those into kind of our contemporary world and the language that would make sense now?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is interesting, especially since mindful without the vowels, opened up. It seems like there's this kind of trajectory that I see happen over and over again with people who walk through the doors of Mindful, which is there's a large portion of people who come in and they say, you know, I've been meditating with an app. I started with Headspace or Insight Timer or one of these other apps. And, you know, it worked for a little while. Like I got some benefit out of it. And then it started to fall off maybe like a month or two or three in, or I hit a plateau. You know, it got like really sort of stale for me. And so they walk into Mindful asking the question, you know, what's next? What else is there? And what they seem to generally find at Mindful is that practicing meditation in a dedicated space with community, with other practitioners that they can have conversations with and share experiences with, and also live teachers that do come from some kind of background, some sort of lineage, is incredibly helpful in terms of the expansion of their practice. Like it really sort of adds another dimension and answers this question of what's next. But then, you know, inevitably, and this kind of just also sort of speaks to samsara, that there's another question of like, ooh, okay, but now what's next? Like what's next after this? And it seems to be what I'm finding sort of underneath that question, what people are really asking for is, but what is the view or what are the teachings that actually give this practice some context? Because I'm sitting here and I'm watching my breath for 30-minute, 45-minute periods in community, which is great, with live teachers, which is great, but it still feels like it's a little flat. It's a little two-dimensional. It seems to be that when there is a little bit more of the view that's introduced that gives the meditation practice context, is when it really comes alive for people and becomes much more kind of applicable. It sort of answers this question of, yeah, but how does this translate into my daily life? Like, how does this translate into my difficult relationship with my partner and, you know, all of my kind of feelings at work? Coming back to your question, you know, am I finding myself in a project of translation? That's a really great question. I never actually thought about it that way. I find myself really trying in the way that I know how to sort of answer this question that I see coming up in classes all the time, which is, yeah, but like, what else is there? Like, what else is next? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, from my perspective is view, a little bit of view.
So that brings us to your book, Tea and Cake with Demons, A Buddhist Guide to Feeling Worthy. So those are interesting word choices. First of all, demons, and then Buddhist. So the book was released in July of 2019 from Sounds True. What inspired you, first of all, to write the book and to use those terms?
Well, the marketing team at Sounds True thought it was a really great title.
It lends itself to images right away. It's like, oh, would you like to see my tea party? Yeah, here we are.
It is. Demons are very provocative, right? Yeah. What inspired me to write the book? You know, I think it was in part this question of what's next, this kind of asking for some kind of traditional view to give meditation practice context and deepen practice. A big part of why I wanted to write about the topic that I wrote about, which is self-worth and all that obscures it, aka our demons, is that for the past decade or so, I've been hosting these group coaching programs for the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, which is so cool. It's so cool. I'm gathering with these sort of relative strangers at first, but you know, over the course of 6 weeks, we all become good friends and very intimate from across 35 different countries. So the school is huge, and they have students from 35 different countries, and I found myself semester after semester and year after year in these groups of predominantly women, some men, but predominantly women, and the conversation would inevitably turn to feelings of self-doubt and you know, this question of like, you know, who do I think I am? I'm not smart enough. I don't have enough resources. I don't have enough time. I'm not like thin enough or pretty enough or, you know, well-studied enough or well-connected enough or, you know, just this kind of like bottomless, I'm not enough in whatever way, shape, or form. And I found it was really interesting because it's people from across so many different lines of positionality, right? People from different countries and different backgrounds and different belief systems and different socioeconomic statuses. But it seemed like there was this one common kind of fear or question that people were asking, which is why don't I feel like I'm good enough? And it is kind of I talk about this a bit in the book. It's kind of the like the biologist sort of view of, you know, if you see one fish wash up on the shore, it's probably, you know, it's a dead fish, no big deal. But if you start to see thousands of fish washing up, you test the water. Like, what's going on in the water? And it seemed to dovetail really nicely with my own exploration of meditation and Buddhism, and how just frankly helpful I found that it was to have some kind of framework that is consistently like reorienting our worldview back towards enoughness and basic goodness, that we are fundamentally okay. We have fundamental wellness, and that yeah, sure, there's you know, some stuff that piled up on top or obscurations or, you know, demons. But that there's nothing wrong with us. There's actually mm-hmm. nothing. We don't need to be fixed. We're whole and complete and sufficient just the way that we are. And having a practice and a set of teachings that was continually kind of pointing back to that and giving me the experience of that, most importantly, not just in theory, but the actual experience of it. I was like, yeah, this is useful to me. And this is something that I see people consistently struggling with. So that was kind of the impetus for the book.
So this is a quotation from the book. For each of us, this demon material is unique, like our own neurotic thumbprint. It's in our difficult emotions, confused states of mind, and the unintegrated aspects of ourselves that cloud our Buddha nature. So what you're saying, I guess, is that the times that we find the roughest, the most disappointing about ourselves, where we're not living up to some standard that we have imposed or the world has imposed upon us that we've taken on, those are the times that actually could be the most transformational, the richest in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, potentially, yes.
What do you think the consequence of that is? Because there's a certain way in which we need to accept and even love those parts of ourselves, you know, rather than reject them and be so afraid and so ashamed and all of that. But we also don't want them to dominate necessarily. We don't want them to run our lives and our choices and so on. So there's a path somehow where the opening doesn't lead to acquiescence. It leads to something else.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I just know from my own experience, it's been so helpful to kind of understand and respect and come to sort of embrace all of my neurotic aspects, like the parts of myself that, you know, maybe I learned along the way that I should be ashamed of, or I had some sort of experience that made me really fearful to show these parts of myself to other people. And so, you know, the kind of strategies that are put in place to like never kind of witness or interact with, or, you know, God forbid, show these parts of myself to other people. And just the ability to sort of turn my attention there as a potential source of wisdom. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, this is, if the theory is that I am whole and complete and sufficient just the way that I am, whole means the entirety, whole means all of it. And mm-hmm. so maybe that does include the aspects of myself that I'm not so proud of. I always think about it for myself. It's in the moments when I feel really overwhelmed or under-resourced, where I'm like, ah, there it is. Mm-hmm. There's my, you know, demon material. That's when, you know, the parts of who I am that I don't necessarily appreciate come to the forefront. And to your point, yeah, I think that there is something about being able to witness and befriend and integrate these aspects of ourselves as aspects of wisdom. Without necessarily like giving them the wheel. It's kind of like, here, climb into the passenger seat. We're going to go for a ride, but, you know, please don't place your hands on the wheel. Like, and please, like, I don't even want you to tune the radio. Like, mm-hmm. I see you. I see you. Thank you for the information. And also, you know, this is maybe not who's in the driver's seat here.
So what do you mean by aspects of wisdom, or thank you for the information? Like, what information do we get from finally sitting down, you know, and paying attention in a different way to these forces?
Yeah. I mean, just to make it really specific, I think for myself, I've always been incredibly prone to anger. you know, to the point of like rage, like particularly righteous anger. There's something that's so deeply satisfying about I'm right. I'm right and you are wrong. And that way I get to like hold this sort of vaulted position of like of just righteousness. And it feels good. It feels really powerful in the moment. And, you know, I think that is the tipping point of like, ooh, this could really kind of take the wheel here, because it does feel kind of satisfying to be in the right and to be so angry. And I think the wisdom aspect of that, just speaking for myself, is that it really is a way of reclaiming some kind of power over my vulnerability, like reclaiming some kind of feeling of agency in the moments when I feel the most vulnerable, as a protective mechanism. And so I think that the wisdom there is, I feel incredibly threatened in this moment, and it feels powerful to be in a place of righteous anger. But then also looking at, you know, is there some truth here? Is there some truth here when I drop the satisfaction of the feeling of anger? Like what is this actually pointing to? Is there some sort of, injustice or wrongdoing at play, that this is in response to, and what might it mean to sort of hold that truth of what's being revealed here, without necessarily letting my anger kind of burn the house down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, in any of these aspects, that there's some truth. It's pointing to the truth of our experience in some real way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now my mind was playing, what about greed? What about this? What about that? You know?
Yeah.
It's interesting. So when I was first practicing Buddhism and learning meditation, it was within a certain tradition, and it was in a certain context. So within that context, say in the beginning of a retreat, an intensive retreat, you would actually recite the five precepts that were going to be the underpinning of your life for that 10-day period or however long the retreat was, not harming another, not killing, not stealing, and so on. And so one of the functions of having that kind of code of ethics, and I should say these are guidelines, they're called training precepts. They're about awareness. They're not about punishment or, you know, having done wrong and failing. It's a different sort of mode. But anyway, one of the benefits I discovered from having that kind of context was that I could more befriend, in a way, the forces that came up in my mind without having this fear like, oh, that's gonna blossom into action. Like, I might really want your beautiful meditation shawl and, you know, long for it and want it. But I know because of that commitment, I'm not going to like reach my hand out, you know, when you're not in the room and like pull it away and hide it in my suitcase, you know, I'm not going to steal it. And in a way that gave me permission to really let it rip, that desire.
Mm.
You know, I could be with it. I could look at it. I didn't have to think, what if, you know, it takes me over. And so it's a funny way of looking at ethics, you know, to see that it really allows us to hang out with those demons and say, okay, you know, this is a part of what arises in my mind. I don't have to sit here quaking, you know, like, am I going to start stealing? Am I going to do this? Am I going to do that? Let me really just be with this feeling in and of itself. And so that just occurred to me, you know, as sort of an ethical context that actually makes us less afraid.
Yeah. 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 That's such a great point, is, you know, maybe the concern of like, what kind of person will I become if I even allow this to be a part of my experience?
Mm-hmm.
Like, nope, just put it in a box. Keep it at bay. Yeah, it, you know, I'm thinking about a couple of months ago, I was teaching meditation at a like multinational bank, which is always a very funny experience because I'm so used to just like sitting on the floor barefoot and mm-hmm. suddenly I'm at the front of a boardroom table. Like, okay, I'm going to tell you something very important now about feelings. You know, we talked, we practiced. Afterwards, there was some Q&A and there was a woman who raised her hand and she said, you know, like, have you ever seen somebody who's had a really adverse reaction to meditation? And I thought about it and I was like, you know, I personally haven't. I personally haven't seen anybody have just like a really terrible reaction to meditation. You know, sometimes you read stories about it. It's oftentimes when, you know, people decide the best way to learn how to meditate is to go on a 10-day silent retreat, which I like really appreciate the spirit of go big or go home, but maybe not the most supportive environment to learn how to meditate.
Well, actually, I learned how to meditate that way.
Did you?
I'd say probably 50%. I don't know about now, but for a long, long, long time, about 50% of the people who'd come to the Insight Meditation Society were beginners.
Wow.
For an intensive silent retreat. I think it's not the most conducive way for everybody, you know?
Right.
And there are big environmental factors like the silence, you know, and the fact that nobody's looking at you. And that might make it really not a good choice for somebody in a particular mode. And that's one of the interesting things about our time is that mm-hmm. now, you know, we ask how many people are new to IMS, but, you know, maybe they've been meditating every day with an app, you know, so they're not really new to meditation, something like that.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. That's a really great point is that It sort of just assumed now that you've kind of dipped your toe into the water with like a 15-minute or mm-hmm, a 30-minute mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, that wasn't always.
No, definitely.
Available.
I mean, there was no choice. There was nothing, you know, it was just retreats and
yeah,
that's how you had to do it. And for most people, it's fine. It's not fine for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, that's a really great point. Thank you for that clarification. Yeah, she approached me afterwards and she said, you know, I asked because I had an adverse reaction to meditation. And I was like, oh, you know, what happened? She said, I just felt so heavy. I said, oh, you know, like mentally heavy, emotionally heavy, physically heavy, like what? And it was like touching a bubble that was ready to pop. She just welled up with tears. It's like, oh, that's the adverse reaction to meditation, is that you encountered something internally that doesn't actually feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be really shocking to people because they're, you know, I think that there is sort of this maybe assumption in modern day meditation that it's going to make you feel good. That's its purpose. The mm-hmm. purpose of meditation mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. to feel good. And you're going to sit down and all of the stress is going to drain out of your body and you're going to sleep like a baby that night. And this is what meditation is for. And so it was a real shock to her to the point that she described it as having a bad reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of my motivations behind this book was really, you know, again, with this question of people who are having a daily meditation practice at this point, maybe asking the question of like, what's next, to really underscore the fact that when we inevitably encounter ourselves in meditation, our own mind, our own emotions, our own hangups, our own neuroses, that doesn't necessarily have to be a problem,
mm-hmm.
but that's, you know, that's okay. That's okay. You're not doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad meditation.
Did you do an audio version of the book? I'm curious.
I didn't. Yeah, that might be in the future. That might be in the cards, but yeah.
Because I was thinking, see, this is sort of what I meant in the beginning of our conversation when I said you started without the ability to ask questions. Because there are many, many moments for anybody where we could use some reassurance or reminders. It's okay. You know, this path is not all bliss and light. There's there's something meaningful in being able to sit with one's sadness and pain and, you know, and discomfort. But you have to do it skillfully, because the idea isn't to suffer. You know, the idea is to really develop a different relationship. And, you know, so I thought, oh, well, someone could keep reading your book. But then I thought it would be nice to just have it in your voice, sort of reminding you, like, it's okay. You know, you're sitting with some demons. And because there's also the question of how long do you sit there? You know, you don't want to get exhausted. And it can't be the only thing. You need to bring some resource, as you said, to the table. You know, you're not sitting there gritting your teeth and like begging to endure. You know, there's a whole relationship to that. I don't want to say demonic energy, but, you know, the difficult energy that you're developing, that you're cultivating. And so what are the components of that different relationship? You talk about love, you know, and you talk about confronting perfectionism and being able to loosen the grip of some of these habits that we have. And that's really important, you know, for people to understand, is that it's not just like this naked confrontation, you know, with something that's very, very difficult, but you're really building resource.
Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think something that I personally found so helpful about the framework of the Four Noble Truths is that it just kind of normalized my situation in a lot of ways. Like, oh yeah, you know, it's hard to be a human being. You're going to have really difficult moments. And you're absolutely not alone in that. And you know, it actually even carries the potential to open our hearts in a way that gives us access to greater empathy, to really be able to not only hold space and bear witness to our own suffering and our own perceived failings and, you know, our own quote unquote demons, but also to then be able to extend that kind of space and empathy to other people. And like, how beautiful is that? Because on the other side is this, you know, at least what I've experienced, like this profound sense of connection. Like, whoa, we are really in this together. We are really in this together. That there is, you know, my suffering is incredibly valid, but it is not at all unique. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, I think for me, took the personalization out of it, like not taking it so personally, and also, you know, gave me that kind of footstool to really being able to draw a line of connection to everybody else, which, you know, how lovely.
I mean, I'm tempted to have you explain the Four Noble Truths, just in case there's somebody listening who is not familiar with that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I love this. I used to have a teacher that would make us run drills. It'd be like four of this, eight of those. So first noble.
No, I should just say this is one of my bugaboos. It came from my own writing and being edited, where my first book was Loving Kindness, and I would get these comments back from, I had a freelance editor, from the editor saying, that's just jargon. Or, what is noble silence? Nobody knows what you're talking about. And I realized, oh, I'm so used to making that assumption that, you know, now I hear even people using a word like dharma. And I realize there may be people in this room that don't know what that word means, which is used in different contexts. It could mean the Buddha's teaching, it can mean the truth, it can mean the laws of nature.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we're so used to it, we just go on. So the stage is yours. What are the Four Noble Truths?
Yeah. I mean, to your point, I think it is always helpful just to have kind of a working definition. I even see this in like commonly used words, like mindfulness is like, okay, you know, we're using this so liberally, which is beautiful that it's such a part of our conversational atmosphere, but also it can be helpful to just have a working definition so that we're all sort of on the same page. First noble truth, truth of suffering or the truth of dissatisfaction. The way that I think about it is, you know, it's hard to be a human being. Being a human being means encountering difficulty. And there's a number of different kinds or flavors of difficulty that we'll encounter. There's the, you know, the suffering of suffering or the dissatisfaction of dissatisfaction. Like, ouch, I stubbed my toe. We can all agree that's painful. It's a really painful experience. There is the painful experience of impermanence that, you know, even if I have exactly the flavor that I want, I got like exactly the thing, oh my goodness, yay, sort of built into receiving the flavor that I want, is that it's not going to last. And that in itself is painful. It's dissatisfactory. And then, you know, what sounds really ominous is the all pervasive suffering or all pervasive dissatisfaction, which, you know, is just kind of that feeling of like, but like, I just want a little something more. Like, I just want a, like a snack, or like, there's nothing necessarily bad that's happening, but I just want to like up level it a little bit. Like, how can I just make this a little bit more tasty? And sort of the restlessness that results from never really being able to settle into our experience, which is what all pervasive suffering or dissatisfaction points to. So second noble truth is that if we're experiencing dissatisfaction in a lot of different forms, just by virtue of being a human being, there's a reason for it. There's a really good reason for it. And it points back to the three root poisons, which is that there's some kind of experience that we always want to be having, and desire, thirst, greed, and its sort of inflamed version. And there's always some sort of experience that we want to be avoiding, aggression, aversion, and that we're always kind of trapped in the tension between the two. Like, I want this and I don't want that. I think advertising does such a great job of this, of like, you know, have this experience without giving anything up, without having the experience you don't want to have. Like, you know, have the love of your life without sacrificing your individuality. So always kind of like caught in the tension of, I want this, I don't want that. Desire, aggression, aversion. And then what kind of props it all up, that kind of like underlining baseline, is ignorance. That we have no idea we're on this cycle all day long, every moment of our lives, of always kind of fiddling with our experience to have the exact kind of experience that we want to be having while not having any of the stuff that we don't want to have. We have no sense that this is happening, ignorance. And also the ignorance of really sort of self-identifying with our circumstances. You know, when things are good, I'm good. Mm-hmm. When things are bad, I'm bad. And really sort of internalizing that and taking that to heart and feeling like, well, this is who I am in the world. I am my circumstances. I am my experience. Third noble truth is, you know, the good news. Yay. There's a way to get off of this treadmill, a way off this hamster wheel, which leads to the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path, that there is actually a very holistic path of practice within the context of our lives, using our life as the grounds of practice, for continually working with the causes of our dissatisfaction and the causes of our suffering, which, you know, is so beautiful. I think it's beautiful to me that it sort of alchemizes our entire lives into a path of practice, path of working with, you know, what causes us so much dissatisfaction. How'd
great.
I do?
You did great. You did so great. You're an A+.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that leads me to another quote from your book. For most of us, there's a moment when we receive the message that we're not quite good enough the way that we are. Perhaps there's a cultural standard that we become aware of, along with the place that we occupy in it. Maybe there's a family dynamic that expects something of us that we find ourselves unable to fulfill, or a disappointment that's assigned to who we are rather than something that we did. Perhaps even the standard of good enough was learned to be rejected as mediocre, subpar. Okay is not actually okay. I felt myself just respond with all this compassion for our predicament, you know, like reading this, like, look at how we struggle.
Yeah. 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 I've always, you know, for myself, I've always had a really hard time with even the idea of enough. You know, what is enough? And I see myself always kind of wanting to occupy one of the two polarities of like abundance, like more than enough. I have so much. Or, you know, when I am not feeling abundant, kind of collapsing into poverty mentality of like, I'm not enough. I'm not enough in any of these ways. Again, going back to these conversations over the past 10 years of the ways in which we feel kind of internally deficient in our own ways, and kind of how difficult I've always found it to find that resting point somewhere in the middle of like just okay, and even in that word okay of like but like it's just okay, right? We think of okay as being like it's a C plus at best, like it's like baseline, but you always want to get better. You always want to get better. And that's such a, it is just such a kind of invisible narrative in our culture of like always more, always climbing, always better. You know, what's like, what's the next thing? Like, keep going, don't settle. And it really is tough. It just, it feeds that struggle of never being able to rest in sufficiency and enoughness, in plenty, which, yeah, you know, again, going back to the second noble truth is like that tension, that continual tension that is an undercurrent in our everyday experience.
Beautifully said. I'm wondering if we could close with just your leading us in a short meditation.
Yeah, thank you. I'd be happy to. Okay, so whomever you are, wherever you are, just taking a moment to find a comfortable seat. Just letting yourself physically land if you haven't already. On a chair, couch, floor, some sort of solid surface where your body can be supported. And then once we've landed, just taking a moment to locate your gaze. So eyes open or eyes closed. And if you're practicing with eyes open, just letting the gaze be soft, hazy, unfocused, 3 to 5 feet in front of you. And practicing with eyes closed, seeing if you can still maintain a sense of being alert and awake, uplifted. Just taking a few moments here to open our practice by opening our senses. Really just locating ourselves here in space. And so shifting the attention over to sound. Just receiving the sound of the room that you're in. Tonal quality. Maybe any noises that are present. It's a welcoming sound to be a part of our experience. And shifting the attention over to touch. So taking a few moments to really just feel into the body, feeling where the body makes contact, that light pressure against the chair, the floor, feeling where the body meets the body itself. Taking in the texture of clothing on our skin. Temperature of the air in the room. So really very little effort needed here. It's beginning to open up to what already is. Just the body here in space, our direct experience of that. Dropping the attention into the feet. Just feeling our feet here. Pressure of our shoes. Texture of the socks. Temperature of the air. It's bringing a bit of interest to the details. Tracing the attention across the shin bones. Circling the kneecaps, grazing through the thighs, landing in the hips. Bringing the attention to the belly, the chest. Maybe just resting here in the belly, the chest for a few beats. Just feeling into the space in the body. Oftentimes the storehouse of emotion in the body. Maybe just noticing if there's anything that feels particularly active or alive here. And what we're bringing into practice. Continuing to rest here in the front body. It's beginning to establish contact with the body breathing. It's feeling the way the breath moves in the body today by its own volition. Wherever, however, the breath is most available in the body. It's dropping an anchor of attention here. Home base, the place that we return to. Just taking a few moments to practice with the singular instruction that as our minds wander, which they naturally will, just noticing when we've left our breathing, acknowledging what captures our attention, and then gently, firmly coming back to the breath in the body. And then in our final few moments here, maybe just offering ourselves a little bit of sweetness kind word, giving ourselves some credit for taking a bit of time, creating a little bit of space, treating our own company like it matters. And then perhaps closing out, just giving ourselves a few more deep inhales, deep exhales, wiggling the toes, rolling out the wrists, just bringing a little bit of movement into the body. And then as you're ready, just letting formal practice drop. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful. And thank you so much for joining me today to speak. And if you would like to learn more about Adriana's work, you can check out her website at www.adrianalimbach, that's ADRIANNALIMBACH.com. Her book, Tea and Cake with Demons, is available in paperback and ebook formats wherever books are sold, and who knows, maybe someday an audiobook. Thanks so much to all of you listening. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be healthy, may you be happy, and may you live with ease.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.